Hello, Woolshift Dustians. Ready for season two of Beacon 23? It starts airing on MGM Plus April 7th, and maybe some other places. More on that in a minute. So we are checking in one last time to get you ready, and not just checking in with you, the listeners, but also checking in with book author and one of the series' EPs, Hugh Howey. We'll get to that in a bit, but first, who's we? Well, who's we, co-host Luke?
Hi, we're back. I'm co-host Luke Minip. I am the guy that hasn't read any of the books. Alicia
just one
has.
Book this time, yeah.
Yeah, just the one book this time, yeah. Although, as you'll hear from the Hugh Howey interview, and if you've listened to our review of season one, the show departs fairly radically from the book this time.
Our usual spoiler is to only spoil what's been aired and nothing that I would know from the books beyond that. But in this case, it's pretty much impossible to spoil beyond that anyway. But we will still take some precautions in the interview, as you'll hear. But yeah, how have you been, Luke? It's been a minute since we heard from you.
It has been a minute. I've been busy writing my own book. It's just due back at the editors at the end of the month. I've also had a spell of poor health. Basically, between actual paid work and not being particularly well, that's sort of why I've been on hiatus for a while.
Yeah, I'm glad you're feeling better this week.
Thank you.
And for those who haven't heard before, what is the book that you've been working on about?
So it is a history of Britain's involvement in the Iraq War. So it really covers the period from the revolution of 1958 all the way up to 2004.
So a nice pairing with a discussion from my Hugh Howey interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I recently dropped in this feed our episode with our wrap-up of season one and with some season two predictions, but that was recorded back in December. How are you feeling about season one of Beacon 23 almost 4 months later?
Well, I, in preparation for this episode, I went back and did a quick rewatch of the final three episodes.
Okay.
My thoughts are still very much the same, which is, oh, poor Bart. Just breaking my heart for Bart. And I'm really looking forward to what comes next, obviously. Season one ended on an absolute doozy of a cliffhanger with what happened with Asta. Mm-hmm. We've still got Aelith and Fiddle and Faddle, the two terrorists, stuck on the beacon, as well as Halen. So I'm really interested to see Aelith and Mutton Jeff stick around. Whether they're going to be like key characters in season two, and also what's happened to Asta, because, you know, Lena Headey is still listed on the IMDb cast list for the show. So we can sort of assume from that that she's going to appear in some capacity.
Right. Well, we know from the trailer that she is showing up we'll talk about that more when we get to the trailers, but we know we're going to see her a little bit, but it seems like she'll be taking a more backseat role this season. But yeah, we're going to dive into that in the third section of the podcast. As far as Beacon 23 in general, though, a little bit of news. It's apparently starting to become officially available outside the US, not here in the Netherlands yet, but several Canadians have confirmed it's there on Prime Video. And there was a press release that says that you can expect to see it on Prime Video also in Australia, New Zealand, and Sub-Saharan Africa, and also on Paramount, which may be Channel 5, MyFive, and Paramount Plus in the UK and Ireland, and the PCCW Media Entertainment Now Studio Video On Demand in Hong Kong and Macau, and on Disney Star in Bulgaria and the Balkans so far. So if anyone finds it showing up in any of those places, let us know. It doesn't seem to be out in the UK quite yet, but that seems to be coming soon.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's no word on Western Europe where I live at this point. But what is interesting is that another MGM Plus show, From, has just had its first season drop on Netflix. But now it seems like everything's dropping on Netflix. That doesn't mean it won't show up elsewhere.
Okay.
Well, it seems like all these, I'm suddenly seeing all these HBO and Disney shows and stuff that are just on Netflix for a small window.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah. Oh, Netflix, I think, is winning the streaming wars. And they're like, okay, oh, you will be a secondary market for the other streamers.
Well, that's kind of depressing.
Yeah. They'll just raise charges even more.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I said, we'll look at the season 2 trailer in a little more depth later in this episode. But first, I got a chance to sit down with Hugh Howey, the author of Beacon 23, to talk about the show, being an executive producer, and changes from his book. And this, as I said before, it's going to be spoiler free beyond, of course, we are going to spoil Beacon 23 season 1 here. But there is a second part where we go into spoilers for the book, the Silo series, and even a little Sand. And that you'll find that second part of the interview on the book club. Luke, you got a chance to listen to this interview already, but let's give our listeners a chance and come back to talk about it. That will come up right after a quick break.
Research request granted. Spoilers unlocked.
I'm here with Hugh Howey, author of the book Beacon 23, as well as the Silo series of books after which this podcast is named, not to mention a bunch of other sci-fi page turners for the thinking man. Thank you for joining me today, Hugh. How are you?
I'm doing great. My pleasure to be here.
So I was just discussing the spoiler policy with you, but for listeners at home, basically we're not going to have book spoilers in the first half of this interview beyond what's been shown on screen in Beacon or Silo. But then we'll save some book spoilers to discuss at the end in a separate section. But I guess it's kind of hard to spoil the TV show Beacon 23 based on the book. It's so different. Was that a surprise
matter
to
of fact,
you?
No, it wasn't a surprise because I was in the writer's room early on, even before that. Zach and I were chatting when he was, you know, trying to figure out how to adapt this to TV. And one of the first things he came up with was one of the biggest deviations, which is the background for Halen, and even giving him a name, which I tried to avoid doing in the book. But I mean, when I wrote the book, I was not thinking about getting TV shows made. It was less just a serialized story for myself.
Right.
And yeah, from the very beginning, we were making major changes. And when my attitude towards getting things adapted is to support the creative energy from all the people who jump in on the project, not to try to keep the book the same, because the book's not going to change.
No, that's true. That's true. I really appreciate, I love the book is just, it's a really fun one. But the TV show is also adding new things in a different way. Silo feels like they're building the world out sideways, and Beacon 23, it feels like they are using, it's a different world, but they're mining a lot of similar ideas. I think, though, a lot of people don't realize that your role in the Beacon 23 adaptation is a bit different than your role with Silo, so that it's you're not always involved to the same degree. On Silo, you're an executive producer, so you get to have a lot of input. And I know, first of all, I know a lot of authors who would love to know how do you get that? How do you secure that? Rights for yourself, the, you know, ability to have that input.
Well, if it was just me, I would probably not have any of those rights, because I am really pretty submissive when it comes to negotiating with Hollywood. But I have agents who are some of the best in the business, and lawyers, and I'm actually an executive producer on Beacon as well. It's kind of like pretty much mandatory for my agents. They will not let me be involved in something if I don't get an EP credit. The amount that I stay involved beyond that is, you know, pretty much up to me and to the producers, like how often do they want me to be in the room? How much do they want? How much notes do they want on scripts for me? And, I would say my involvement on Silo was more, but my involvement on Beacon was quite a lot. Like I was in, basically just moved in with Zach for a week, and we hung out every day going through how to structure the story and what kind of story to tell, what the seasons would look like if we got more seasons. Cause it was a pretty big challenge how to turn, you know, what could be an easy hour and a half feature film into a much bigger TV show. Cause the book is,
Right.
Doesn't have enough material for a TV show. We had to come up with new conflicts and new characters.
Yeah. How does it work with the rights? Could there be a feature film version that's more faithful to the book?
Yeah. I mean, given enough time, everything will be adapted an infinite number of times, I think. I would say in a million years, we'll have like, there'll be 5,000 Spider-Man more movies to watch. You could choose your favorite. I also think we're going to get into a world pretty soon where fans will be able to make their own versions of every book because of AI tools. They won't be maybe the same polish, but they'll be able to see almost every story visualized that you've ever wanted to see.
Well, I know a lot of people who are really into the fan fiction community, and yeah, they are kind of exploring the multiverse of their favorite worlds, I guess.
Yeah, I've had a lot of that with both of these worlds, Silo and Beacon, a lot of fan fiction. And yeah, I don't know what the timeline will be, but 100 years from now, for sure, creating fan fiction versions of films and TV shows will be as simple as what we do with written fan fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I of course have to fall down on the side of I love new original stories, but I see there's no reason why people shouldn't, you know, in a sort of video game kind of way, explore the different possibilities.
If it helps me anyway to think about fan fiction through the lens of other art forms. So when you start playing a musical instrument, you rarely pick up a guitar and start figuring out a brand new chord progression. You play covers, Stairway to Heaven. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you play covers for years before you learn the basic techniques from those hits to start writing your own music.
Right.
Anyone who's ever painted, you know, has done a still life, has painted a bowl of fruit. So I think we imagine this like ex nihilo creativity in writing in a way that we don't expect it from any other art form. And I'm not sure why that is, but it is a pretty universal thing. We have a distaste for.
Well, I don't have a distaste for fan fiction just for, if it's coming, I guess just for it being able to be generated too quickly, you know, because then I worry about it losing the soul and, you know, the, what makes it special, what makes people really fall in love with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think instead of seeing the fan fiction as the output, we have to see it as the practice and the process and know that writer who's taking an interest in that is going to eventually write that original story that you're going to fall in love with.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because you learn by, I mean, I know in my growing up, you know, in school, we were taught to copy, write this in the style of Camus, write this in the style of Steinbeck. And by doing that, we could learn to find our own styles and learn how to play with the tropes and that makes sense. So the Beacon 23, though, the series went on quite a roller coaster before landing at MGM Plus, but I guess Silo did as well. Was there a moment where you thought both might fall through?
The entire time, I thought both would fall through. I never expect anything to make it onto the screen. And I think that has allowed me to ignore the process for 10 years while I just concentrate on other things. Not only does it not help to agonize over some of these projects, I think it could be really harmful to them. Like if you're the author who's constantly pinging people saying, what about this and what about that? And you're whining online about it, like just putting all that negativity into the project.
Right.
Not even in a karmic system, but in a, like, why do we want to work with someone who's, you know, a squeaky wheel?
Right.
And then we have this other project and no one's bothering us about it and we can just work on it on our own time. So it keeps me sane, and I think it probably gave both projects a better chance of getting made.
So you say you give, you know, once you sign the rights to this to someone, you give them the space to develop it, and then you say, come back to me when you're ready to talk more?
Yeah, like if you have any questions or want me to read a script and get feedback, you know, we have several projects that are underway that no one even knows are being worked on, and I don't tease things or update people on them. I sometimes forget things are being worked on, and then a script gets sent to me. I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. And then we'll get the rights back to something and figure out like how to go back out with it again.
Yeah. Well, Well, it's coming from good source material. So the Beacon characters, we talked about already that Halen is just a new name, but basically the kind of the same protagonist. And of course, Rocky showed up and the lighthouse poster. But basically everyone else is new in name, at least. Do you see any more analogies between any of the characters in the show and characters from the book?
I think Aster is pretty pretty much taken from the other
Scarlet?
Lighthouse keeper who sets up, you know, you don't meet her till halfway through the book. But what happened, I think if you told the story the way the book's told, the first episode, probably there's zero lines of dialogue. You know, it's just Halen or Digger going through the motions of like trying to save a ship and failing. And I don't know, it'd be very avant-garde to do that. I'm not sure if we would keep people through a whole season if that was our first episode. So kind of the direction from the studio was, how do we get, and we'd already had Lena Headey cast at this point. And if you're paying for Lena, you want to, you know, get Lena
on
camera.
You're not going to waste her. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, how do you get Lena on, you know, on camera?
One.
Yeah. From like 5 minutes in rather than episode five, you know? So that takes a major rethinking of like, what's the plot? And then when you're in the room, you're like, well, what are the important things? What's the story about? And what are we trying to tell a story about? And for me, the story was about a soldier suffering from severe trauma and depression.
Right.
And thinking that if he ran away from the war that gave him those scars, that they would heal, when solitude is one of the worst things that we can experience as humans. It's the way we punish people in prison. Like you're already in prison. How do we make you in prison more? You know, we make you be by yourself and with your thoughts and no distractions. So his prescription was the worst thing he could have done for himself. And retaining all of that, I think, was like the real challenge and the what we were aiming for with the adaptation. Like, and how do we show catharsis? And you know, it'll take another season to get to that, but that's really the goal of the show.
Right. And okay, so two questions come from that. One is that I notice in the book, especially, it's really is about his identity as a soldier. And you talk a lot about the military and the experience of being that. And I was wondering what inspired that, or what made you very interested in exploring that subject when writing these short stories the book is made up of.
Well, I've never been in the military. I find it fascinating. I think it's one of the great tragedies of human existence that over time, and it's largely fallen to young men to be kind of conscripted against their will. If you look over human history, most of it is against their will, into going off and fighting for the ego of a handful of people who don't put themselves usually in harm's way, and leaving behind families and mothers and sons and daughters to like fend for themselves and suffer in other ways, and being the same people on the receiving end of suffering because of all the civilian harm, and the fact that we have, you know, baited into orbit and done so many amazing technological, artistic things, but war has not gone away, like what we see in Ukraine and in the Middle East right now. It's such a tragedy. And so it's something I've explored even with my very first book, a young adult sci-fi space opera. I wrote a lot about war in that book. So I'm writing about it not through someone who's experienced it. I've got my own, you know, traumas and near-death experiences. But one of the things that I find really perverse is that we celebrate war and people who go to war in a really strange way, instead of all just being really sad about it and seeing it as a failure.
Yeah.
Instead, where if we see someone in uniform, instead of saying like, man, I'm sorry that you're having to do this because of, instead we're like, thank you for your service, now board the airplane first. Like, the, you know, we salute, we honor, and there shouldn't be any honor with the necessity of war at all. And yeah, so it's really, as much as I talk about war in Beacon 23, it's an anti-war book. It's very much a book about a desire for peace.
Right. No, that does shine through. So the other question that came out of what you were talking about before is I did wonder if there was any bit of, in the book, I did talk about this in the podcast already. There's this woman, Scarlet, who shows up, and Aster kind of reminded me of her in the fact that she seemed there to deliver the message from what is the artifact in the books, but artifact in the show, Riff in the books.
Yeah, I think, Scarlet has a pretty tragic character arc in the book. And I think she brings part of, in the book, Digger, in the story, Halen's past back to him to help unlock, you know, what the universe is trying to, the message is trying to send to him. And one of the hallmarks, I think, of adaptation with people who are reading books and trying to figure out how to turn them into scripts, they're looking at which characters they can combine, like how to simplify the casting. If something can be done by the same character, like in Silo, we got rid of, the mechanic who worked in IT, who gave a very important piece of information. It's like, can we get that from someone else?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a huge part of the story. And it's sad not to have him in the adaptation, but there was a way of doing it without him that kept us from having to cast and add pages. And, you know, it's really seeing how the sausage is made. It's very eye opening. And there's just conversations all the time about that. Really, a lot of them boil down to budget. Like, can we afford to make it this way?
Right. Like Cricket, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And it is one of the interesting behind the scenes things. We tried to figure out how to make Cricket work, which for people who haven't read the book, there's alien races in the book, and alien races are a big kind of challenge for adaptation because they're expensive. It's CGI. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a day where a dog trainer came out to our little writer's room and brought some dogs and showed them like what dogs could do. Cause we're thinking we could dress a dog and pull this off. So we toyed with the idea, but in the end, again, it came down to budget.
Yeah. I mean, it's also animals are difficult to work with on set, right? It's like, you warned that maybe we shouldn't hold our breath for Shadow and Silo.
I think Shadow. Yeah. I don't know that we will try to pull that off, but cats are probably the least troublesome of all of them because they're expected to be chaotic, right? Like they're not really interacting with humans the way dogs do. So, but yeah, again, that might be an unfortunate casualty, but I don't think you could do it any more powerfully than the book does anyway. I get more emails about Shadow than I think about any other character I've ever written about.
So what are some of your favorite changes from Beacon 23 to the TV show, like new characters or themes added?
I really like the TV show is very philosophical. There's a lot of depth to what the story is exploring. In the book, it's mostly about personal trauma and the cycle of war. And there's, AI wasn't really a buzzword back when I wrote the book, and now it's everywhere. And so some of these major characters that have been introduced that Zach came up with are really delving into, you know, questions of immortality and what it would mean to have copies of ourselves and what it means to interact with AI. So
it's almost a religious element.
Very religious. And I think that's what, I think people who are dreaming of singularity, which is this Ray Kurzweil spearheaded idea, these are people who don't have religious belief who are trying to achieve the same thing that religious people have, which is some hope of an eternal life. And I think you're going to see a technium kind of, like a religious adherence to like pushing technology as fast and as forward as possible in order to achieve some of the same things that some of the same comforts that religion provides.
Yeah. And well, okay, I'm going to save that question for the spoiler section. It has to do with the end of the book. But how much do you know about what will happen in season two of Vegan 23? Have you seen final scripts, or is it going to be a surprise to you?
I've read all the scripts. Okay. And so I will say that at one point I knew what happened. I've read so much since then that and I found this true even of Silo. I was sitting, you know, beside my wife at like right when the episode dropped, we would start watching it. And she would say, like, what happens next? And I would say, honestly, I cannot remember. I've read these scripts so long ago, watched the daily so long ago.
Of more fun for you, right?
It's so much more fun. I love forgetting. There's so many of my favorite books and movies I wish I could forget to watch them for the first time. But yeah, so I can't keep straight the differences. And you read so many versions of the scripts that you forget which ones were shot, because entire scenes. Right.
Exactly.
Would be taken out. So yeah, it's surprising for me, and I'm looking forward to season two, because season one asked a lot of questions and season two is going to answer them. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. Season two, we have new showrunners, but it was still filmed back to back. So how much was shuffled around when the new showrunners came in?
I think a lot of the shuffling happens, you know, with editing, but there was a lot of writing, you know, while there was writing for season two, while season one was shooting. And what happened, I think season one started filming and everyone was just like blown away by the cast and the sets, right, and what we were getting. Yeah. And so they were like, while we have all this built and while we have these people under contract, yeah, let's shoot, you know, this many more episodes. So, I think the fun thing was just coming in, knowing that we had the backing of the studio to tell more story. And it allowed, like, you know, a lot of creativity and imagination. And also knowing that we were probably, I think you can tell a stronger story when you know how much story you get to tell. So if we were trying to tell season two and we're like, are we going to tell five seasons? We have no idea. But mm-hmm. we had a pretty good sense. Okay, there's going to be two seasons to wrap this up. That gives us the freedom to, like, you know, tell a definitive conclusion.
So there's no thought, maybe season three, it's just, this was intended to be a two season story at the end.
That's my feeling.
Okay.
Hollywood is so impossible to know. Like,
right.
I've seen shows get revived because of reception and other ideas. And I, you know, the cool thing about The Beacon, similar to some of my other stories, you know, this is Beacon 23. So there's like a lot of universe to tell stories in.
Sure.
So I could see 5 years from now someone saying like, let's do an animated feature for, you know, just to stream on Hulu or Netflix. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about, but it sounds awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah. No, I have to think of Dune a bit with, you know, they're just these little teases in both the book and the show, that, like, Dune ended up being written, you know, someone came back and wrote, speaking of fan fiction, entire novels to fill in those gaps, and things like where Aster says, oh, this is the, I don't remember, the view from this side of Orion, like, well, how big is this universe, what is the government like, what's going on in the other beacons, like, I need to know about Beacon 21, you know, is the AI like Bart, or probably not.
Yeah, there's so much you could explore, and that's the beauty of fan fiction, really, not just for the readers but the people who write them. The first thing I ever wrote was kind of like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fan fiction. And it's just because I finished reading the book when I was like 12 and didn't want it to be over. So I just grabbed, you know, my dad's computer and started, you know, pecking away at more adventures.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I'm going to end the non-spoiler section with a more general question from my co-host, Luke. He asks, when you're writing, do you tend to come up with characters first or plot?
That's a great question. I would say the idea probably comes first, but I have ideas all the time. I could have, you know, 100 story ideas in a week, but none of those ideas are ones that I seize on and want to work on unless really quickly the character being impacted by that idea comes to me. So the idea comes first, but it's not like I have an idea that I have to, like, okay, now I need to figure out a character I'm usually on to the next idea and then the next idea. And then I'll come up with an idea and say, oh, how would that impact, you know, this person in that world? Mm-hmm. And that's when I want to start writing. So I really don't get attached to the idea until I have a character to see it through.
Okay. So like the world is kind of thought experiments until there's a being that creates more urgency in it.
Absolutely.
So Luke, what did you think of his answer to your question?
I thought that was a really interesting answer to the question. Also, I like Hugh Howey's attitude towards adaptation. I think that's probably the right attitude to have, but I mean, obviously I'm writing nonfiction and he's writing fiction, but I would mm-hmm. find it very difficult to let go of my work, to let go of my babies to that extent. Right.
So you don't want Ridley Scott to adapt your book.
Yeah. So I think it's like an incredibly healthy attitude to have towards adaptation. And I like the fact that, he's basically as involved as an EP as showrunner or the writers want him to be. Mm-hmm. That's probably the right way to do it. I love the fact that, he'll be reading scripts, and because he's read them like 6 months or a year before the show is actually recorded, he's still got no idea what's going on. I think that's like the perfect situation. It's like the ideal veil of ignorance. I've written the thing, but I've completely forgotten what's going on.
Yeah, but it's also like anyone who's ever read shooting scripts, and then like when I've worked in games, you know, I was working on a tie-in game for the Valerian movie. So I got the shooting script of that movie, and I've read all of the Valerian comics and stuff too. And but still some of the things in the game, we would send them to Luc Besson to get approved, and they would have changed in the movie from the shooting script. It was so hard, difficult to explain to people. Like, just because it's in the shooting script doesn't mean it's on screen.
Also, top class name drop there, Alicia. Just top class name drop.
I mean, I don't know him personally. I just worked on a project for one of his films once.
Cool.
So were there any other surprises in the interview for you?
No, I mean, I think it's interesting, the idea that, because obviously I haven't read the Beacon 23 books. I think it's interesting that he's talking about most of the book being an internal monologue. And so you kind of have to invent characters to allow, Halen, to allow Digger to externalize what he's thinking. I do like the idea of like a really avant-garde show that's just like internal monologue. I thought that I don't know whether it's deliberate, but I thought the fact that the character's name is Digger in the books is,
yeah, well, that's just what he calls him. He doesn't really have a name in the book.
Okay.
Well, so that's apparently Hugh Howey's private nickname for him.
Yeah, well, Digger is the Australian equivalent to a Tommy or a GI in US like military slang. So I thought that was interesting. I don't know whether there is like any meaning for meaningful?
Well, it definitely is. Yeah, it definitely is. As you heard, it's very much a book about the military. And you can see that in the show, too.
Yeah.
That it's still...
I just to pick up on something, just to put my professorial hat on for a second, just to pick up on what Hugh Howey was saying about conscription and soldiers, you know, being compelled to fight. Actually, there's a good deal of like psychological and sociological evidence to suggest that's actually not how conscription works. It's not that people are compelled to fight. When you try and force people into the armed forces, that's when you get rebellion and revolution. Mm-hmm. Mostly conscription works because people on some level consent to be conscripted. And that there is expectation.
The way he was using conscription, I guess maybe this is an American UK thing, but he was meaning people who are drafted.
Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing still applies. So all military service is on some level voluntary, or is at least done with tacit Consent. I mean, anyway, it's not a big...
Like, he's definitely thinking about specific drafts that we've had in the U.S. Yeah. throughout history where you're just, it's not voluntary. It's you, people try to get out of it, but they would literally just say anyone between these ages who's born on this day.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is people have to still be willingly part of that system. When you actually try and force people to do that, that's where the whole system breaks down. So yes, there are always individuals that dodge a draft. There are always individuals that resist either passively or actively, but mostly people go along with it because it's the path of least resistance.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is a UK-US difference because there's definitely been a rich history of people who did not want to be set to fight and were forced to do so. And the problem in the US, as is the problem with most things in most places, is that the people with more money tend to find reasons to get out of it. And that's true. The people who have fewer means, fewer connections, who are the ones who are forced to go through with it.
I actually looked into this as part of my PhD research. I actually did part of it is on the mechanics of the draft in Vietnam. And actually, the really interesting thing you find there is it's often talked about as if there is a racial bias towards like drafting people of Black or Hispanic heritage. The numbers actually don't bear that out. What there is a sharp class distinction.
Yeah, that's what I would
So expect. Yeah. you were just as likely to be drafted if you were poor and white than if you were poor and Black. But what's really interesting
but
as well is
there's a lopsidedness into who has the money.
But what's really interesting is it's not the people at the very top of the wealth structure that actually dodge the draft. They actually volunteer in disproportionate numbers.
Okay, they get to be officers.
Yeah, partly because there's a tradition of service. So it's actually people in the middle that are most likely to draft dodge. I will take my professorial hat off because I think we've got off on quite a long digression there. But I thought it was...
No, but that's just following up on the conversation I had with Hugh Howey. Yeah. Like, this is... He'd be happy for us to be discussing this in relation to his books. He'd be happy that his work has sparked this conversation.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, we do have a second half of that interview with Hugh Howey where we go into spoilers, including Silo and Sand spoilers. And you'll find that in the book club, link in the show notes. And I've also left timestamps in the show notes for that episode where the spoilers are and what book they're spoiling. But there are a few things we talked about in that second half that might be of general interest. So just to run down a few, tease a little. So Silo season 2 is finishing filming or has finished filming right about now. So there was, of course, strike delays, but it's all wrapping up now. And Hugh Howey has seen the dailies and he sounds even more psyched about this season than season 1. Season 3 is not officially greenlit yet, but the scripts are ready for when it is. And Hugh Howey also has a new Silo short story coming out this year that he sounds really excited about. He says it's one of his favorite things that he's written in a long time. And also the third Sand book is expected this year still. And beyond that, he has many irons in the TV production fire. So I think we're looking at the beginning of a rich producing career for him. And he also teased that he'll be back on this pod to catch up again after this season of Beacon 23 wraps up so we can dissect what we're all about to witness over the next couple of months.
Awesome.
We're going to take one last quick break and come back with some community feedback and our final season 2 preseason predictions based on the new trailer released 2 weeks ago.
The Quantum Tunneler has new messages.
So we are back. And yeah, I was during our little break while we were dealing with life health stuff, I've been collecting some feedback from our listeners. So just to go through some of it now. So this has been collected over the past couple of months. We have Coco Colburn says, wow, just finished the last episode of Beacon 23 season 1. After screaming, no, when the final scene happened, I watched the trailer for season 2, which looks even better. Still confused by what's going on, LOL, but loving the trip. Looking forward to season two. More answers as to what is behind the quantum AI and the relationship to the QTA, and more insights into what is behind the artifact. Is it AI too? And more spaceship fighting. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, I mean, definitely no is the correct response to that final scene from season one. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to all of that. I don't mean we can talk about this when we get to the trailer, but I'd also like to know more about the column, who they are, what they mm-hmm. think, and what their motives are. And yeah, I'm interested to see how much of Aelif we get in this season, whether he's a permanent character or whether he is just somebody who pops in and out.
Yeah, he was prominently featured in the trailer.
Yes, he was.
So I think, by the way, the quantum AI and the relationship to the QTA, I'm guessing that the QTA, I guess they existed before the quantum AI. I'm still guessing their name is the Quantum Tunneling Agency. And then Aelif, I'm forgetting how to pronounce his name, that he invented the quantum AI. And I think my guess, and what we kind of talked about before, is that Harmony is maybe a sort of evolution of this Hope quantum AI he created based on his daughter.
Yeah, I think that's certainly one possibility.
So Sub-Zero commented after episodes 7 and 8. Oh no, I think I missed the window for feedback on episodes 7 and 8. I lost track of time. Well, there's the window never closes as long as we're still making episodes. So they said there's a trippy, hallucinogenic, sudden way to how they cut from one scene to the next that is probably intentional, but it threw me off a bit throughout the series. Otherwise, I think the series grew on me, especially in the second half. The relationship between Halen and Aster really solidified in the last couple of episodes. That montage of their shift changes was funny and endearing. You could see their bond growing stronger by the day. I kept waiting for one day where they both just stayed in bed together, winky tongue out face. As for the ending, I think I'm in a wait and see state. A lot hinges on how they pay off the cliffhanger in season two. I really hope what happened to Aster at the end was either not real or gets quote unquote fixed somehow. What do you think, Luke?
Oh, I think it was definitely real.
Yeah, I think so
too. Whether or not it gets fixed, quote unquote, whether Aster like returns in some non-corporeal or even corporeal form, maybe who knows. I think we might have said this in the review of the episode when we looked at episode 7, but I hope they strip that bed regularly, or that was gonna get, that was gonna get really crunchy really fast. Yeah, I mean, in terms of what happens to Aster, I mean, she is dead. That version of Aster is dead.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any ambiguity about that.
No, and like, the season two trailer lingers on that fact too.
Yeah. But whether that means Aster is dead is a different question.
Yeah, it seems we're going to get some interaction with her, but I think her corporeal form is gone.
But the interesting, well, we'll talk about that when we get to the trailer.
No, go ahead, say it.
What I'm wondering is, so that is we see Lena Headey on the view screen in the trailer for season two, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's Aster. That could be the aliens using Aster's image, memories, whatever, to try and communicate with Halen. That doesn't, just because we see Lena Headey, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's Aster. That could be another version of Aster. That could be the intelligence using Aster's image to try and communicate with Halen. So I think it's ambiguous as to what happened to the character, or whether the character is returning.
Yeah. Yeah, because also we saw in the first season that Halen's old military buddy, Gashad, we saw him talking to quote-unquote her, but was it her? Did she somehow join, you know, the spores, the artifact, whatever happened with Aster as she was dying? Or was it just these spores using a projection of someone they know Halen trusts to manipulate him?
Because the thing I keep coming back to is this whole idea of communicating with an intelligence that's not human. And I keep thinking of the bait and switch they do in Star Trek The Motion Picture, where Ensign Ilea is killed and then V'ger like uses her image, uses her memories to send back a probe, you know, a means of communication with the crew of the Enterprise. So I wonder mm-hmm. whether it's that kind of deal.
Hmm. Yeah. We also got an email from Rick, and Rick said, who's, by the way, also the one, if you listen to the teaser for the Oscars episode, and I explained the whole situation with my hearing, Rick was the one who gave the tip for doing the hot water over your ears that helped save his eardrums one time. But anyway, he says, I've enjoyed your podcast on Beacon 23. And he said he was looking forward to, you know, getting the end of the season, which is now out, of course. And he says, I'm particularly interested in hearing your reactions to that finale and to that very annoying cliffhanger. By the way, I listened to all your podcasts you guys did on the Silo series and thought it was by far the best and most comprehensive discussion of the three major podcasts I listened to in that series. Oh, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Rick. That's very sweet of you.
He said, I especially liked how you, Alicia, kept your knowledge of the books close to the vest and didn't reveal what you knew about the various spoilers in the story, such as the true nature of Bernard, the fake display in the helmets, etc. Yeah, I had a lot of fun seeing your thoughts on Bernard evolve without my interference. I frankly think Silo was ultimately a much better series than Beacon 23, but I'm still willing to give Beacon another look when it returns in April for season 2.
See, now that's interesting, because If you'd asked me that question after the first three episodes of Beacon 23, I think I would have to agree. I think Beacon 23 takes a bit longer to get going than Silo, but by the back three episodes, I would say they're on about, yeah, I would say they're on par with each other, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think maybe Beacon 23 takes a little longer to get going.
Yeah, and I think they are fundamentally different shows, because Beacon 23 is, you know, Silo, of course, is also a lot about society and you know, psychology and internal things like that. But there's also a good amount of action in there. And it's also clear they got a much bigger budget. And this one really is kind of, I think people might expect it to be more of an action show, but it's really more of an internal show.
Like, yeah.
I think that we might even see, I don't know how much action we'll see in the second half. We'll see. I think it's going to be, they're describing season 2 as a psychological thriller.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, Rick wraps up. Thank you for doing such a great job in your reviews, and I look forward to the podcast. Take care. Thank you, Rick. We also heard from Stu very recently, who said, just listen to the season wrap up of Beacon 23. Thanks for your expressions of support. Give Luke my thanks. Scanning eagerly to see when and where Beacon 23 will appear in the UK. We'll see if I can get a rewatch in before season 2. Lots of threads to pick up on from the finale. Definitely some focus on transhumanism, especially as Aster is now non-corporeal. Let's see if there is an interaction between her and the AIs. And if they lean into the difference, yeah, that's a good question. Will the AI, like, will Harmony be able to see her?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question. And given the amount of time that Harmony and Aster spent together, and like the undoubted friendship bond between them, I think there's more chance of Harmony being able to see Aster than Bart being able to see the anomaly, for example, because, like I say, there's a relationship there that Bart and Aelith don't have with the artifact.
Although Bart did have that relationship with Rhee Avalon, the doctor who set him up, and she disappeared into the artifact as well.
That's true.
What if Bart were somehow in the artifact now?
Oh, I really hope that's true. I really, really hope that's true. I really, really, I hope he's okay and Solomon is like burning in the hottest corner of hell, frankly.
Or at least some sort of backup for Bart. I don't know. There was definitely not a mention of him in the trailer. So, but of course they wouldn't give that away.
Yeah, they wouldn't do that.
And so Stu continued, why is it AI can't detect the artifacts? Yeah, so this is a question that definitely I think might be at the center of this season. And yeah, Stu concludes, good bumper episode of the pod, and was good to hear you and Luke bantering away in Beacon 23. Keep on keeping on. And yeah, we're glad to be back bantering about Beacon 23 as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have a new trailer that came out a couple of weeks ago, in addition to the teaser that came out at the end of season one. So you'll find links to both of those in the show notes. Most of the teaser is pretty much sucked up into the trailer, so we're going to be talking about that trailer right now. Now, yeah, Luke, no sign of Fiddle and Faddle in this trailer, but no sign of Keir either. So
yeah, it's odd.
I think, I mean, we've got to deal with the fallout of him killing Aster, of course. I've almost said Lena.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't give Keir very good odds for survival, because if Halen doesn't kill him, Fiddle and Faddle probably will. So I think he would be dispatched in relatively short order. The thing that I found interesting is the beacon itself looks in pretty ropey condition.
Right. Well, Bard had that meltdown.
Now there's no AI to run the automated systems. Like, it looks to me like the beacon itself is starting to degrade, its systems are starting to break down. So I thought maybe one of the sort of issues they can look at in the early episodes is how does the beacon actually run without Bart, without an AI to manage it? Because there are shots in that trailer where the beacon's looking distinctly battered and run down.
Yeah, and at what point is that just from Bart's meltdown, or is that from all the incursions of the different people we see come in? We'll talk about
yeah,
there. Yeah. And by the way, I looked up on IMDb. And well, first of all, we know IMDb is not always right, because it says that there are 9 episodes, and I'm pretty sure that there are 8 episodes, but it does have Fiddle and Faddle listed for the first few, but I didn't see Keir, so I don't know. We're going to see. And yeah, also, again, Halen wasn't in there, and we know that he's coming back.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And we seem to be getting a new beacon keeper, which is...
Yeah.
Odd, given the circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, as Hugh Howie and I were discussing in the interview, Iris, you can see from that trailer, book readers know she's definitely playing the Clara role, because as Hugh Howie said, that's another beacon keeper who shows up halfway through. Now, again, no idea if their stories are going to align, but playing this role, it's definitely going to be one of the main characters this season, you can tell. It's Helen Wong, who's probably best known for the TV show Glow, about the women's world of wrestling on Netflix. Really good show for anyone who hasn't seen it. Luke, what do you think of this new Iris? Do you trust her?
I don't know if I trust her, but I don't know how she's got that. Like, surely QTA and ISA must have... I mean, ISA are sort of, notoriously rubbish at everything, but even they must have worked out by now that something is amiss on Beacon 23, so...
Right. Well, maybe that's why they sent... Because she would come from the ISA as a beacon keeper, I think, if I understand the show world correctly.
So it seems kind of odd to just send one person in those circumstances. You would think they'd be, like, sending out some massive, like, posse to figure out what the heck's going on. So I don't know... We've got to remember that Halen, was initially passing himself off as the beacon keeper when he wasn't. So I wonder whether it's a similar situation.
Yeah. Well, we do see what looks like, or at least they cut the trailer together this way to look like Harmony is saying to Iris that Halen needs Iris. So Harmony seems to trust her, but I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe she's from the QTA then.
Yeah, and I mean, Harmony, as we sort of found out from the last episode of season one, Harmony's not in complete control of her actions.
Yeah.
She's sort of coded to follow Aelith's instructions. So I think we have to take everything Harmony says at this point with a pinch of salt. And yeah. I wondered as well whether Harmony has been, like, plugged into the beacon, whether she's, like, having to double up as, like, performing some of Bart's functions. Because there's one shot at the very end of the trailer where it looks like Harmony is doing her dissolving thing, but it looks painful. It looks like something has gone wrong.
Yeah, she's like glitching or bugging out. She's screaming somehow. I was wondering, could it be a response to Aster's death, or is this something else that happened?
My sort of idea with that is maybe she's having to do Bart's job as well as her own role, and that's kind of, it's putting too much stress on her program, on her software. So she's having like the software equivalent of like overwork and a mental health episode.
I wonder if it would be so taxing on her, or if she's so evolved that it would be like just background functions.
Well, I don't know, but the thing is, even if she's advanced, she's still not programmed to do Bart's. She would still have to learn how to do Bart's role, in addition to being like the personal AI of Halen now. So I just wonder whether it's like her programming being stretched too thin, or that was what occurred to me when I saw the trailer. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we also see her, she's talking about her feelings, like she lists a lot of feelings, fear and anxiety, and she's listing, yeah. She's sounding very human, so I wonder, will we see her develop more toward her humanity, or will that be uncovered more and we'll find out she had more of it all along? And yeah, will she ultimately be a hero or a tragic figure?
And this was the thing in season one, towards the end of it, she was like really struggling to understand what Bart was going through. I mean, she was sort of sympathetic towards Bart, but she couldn't really get a handle on why Bart was so upset. And she basically did the classic thing you're never supposed to do of telling Bart, you know, not to get upset, basically.
And that's how we know Bart's human, because it does the opposite.
So, yeah, I think watching Harmony develop is going to be an interesting part of the season.
We also had Aleph said that Halen is the only one who can decipher the message. So we got to wonder if that is before Iris comes, because then, yeah, obviously, and after, you know, Twiddle and Twaddle leave and Kier, whatever happens to poor Kier. He killed.
Yeah, I'm going with kicked out the airlock.
Yeah, good chance. Although, yeah. I don't know, Halen is not really a murderer, we've learned.
It's true.
Although maybe, well, and I would think that the spores would not be upset about this development, because it gives them what they want. They wanted her to merge with him in the first place since she was a child, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, we do also know, speaking of her as a child, we have an actress credited as a teenage Aster this season. So that makes me wonder, I guess we're going to get some flashbacks, maybe even see another location like that colony Menelaus where she grew up.
That would be cool.
Yeah,
that would be cool. Although I do wonder with that, like the description of Menelaus has been so grim across so many episodes. I wonder whether anything you could actually show on screen would actually live up to how unpleasant and grim it's described as being. Like the water tastes like graphene, and
well, no, it's worse than the place where the grotto.
You're right. It's worse than the place where the water tastes like graphene.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, they can do their favorite thing where they make the screen too dark.
Yeah.
To say, at least this show hasn't been so guilty of that, have they?
No, not so far. But yeah, I have a fear that if they do show Menelaus, it's going to be in permanent shadow.
Yeah. And then we get flashes of a bunch of different potential antagonists. So first we have this guy with a bubble helmet who looks like he should be called Ant-Man, and he's got like the spanking stick. And
I've got to say, that did look fairly ridiculous.
He's supposed to inspire fear? I don't think so. But it says, at the same time he's shown, so whether or not this is true, Iris is saying Beacon 23 is under military attack. So I guess we're, at this point, supposed to assume he's from the military, like mm-hmm. Halen. So did Halen wear this? No, we've never seen Halen wear this.
Yeah, maybe we'll look better in context, but yeah, I gotta say, I watched the trailer and that did make me smirk.
It feels like too intentional, like it's gotta be, because yeah. We also get someone who is also a more anatomically correct the wasp, but this person has a gun and we can't see their face. So it could be someone we know or know by that point, but they also just in general look way more intimidating.
Mm.
The gun helps, I guess.
Yeah.
And then do you think, by the way, the guy with the bubble helmet, do you think he's kind of inspired by classic British police uniforms?
I was thinking Judge Dredd. I was thinking.
I was thinking cartoon Judge Dredd.
I was thinking sort of second rate Judge Dredd cosplay, as he said.
Judge Dredd from Wish.
Yeah.
And so we also got hooded people with painted foreheads. They look kind of culty. Who do you think they might be?
Yeah, I'm like, I was thinking like column elders, column priests, column.
Yeah, they're not wearing the white like here.
Then they're not wearing the white, but column priests, column elders, column scholars. Like, because we're not really. This is one of the things I hope they really sort of clear up: is the column. Are the column a religious sect? Are they? Is it religion? Is it philosophy?
Where's the line? I guess.
Yeah. What is it? What is it they actually believe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we see someone wielding a flamethrower later in the trailer, and you just see her from the back. So I don't know. It could be one of those, or it could be I saw someone else. If you go to IMDb and you go to season two episodes, you can see character names for a bunch of these people. But yeah, since none of these people are from the book, I know no more about this than you do. It's just all guessing at this point. One interesting moment is at the end. We see Halen lying on a beach, which I don't know if this is real or hallucination. That's a question. And there's a voice over it, which is either alien or AI. And this might actually come from a completely separate scene and they just splice them together.
Yeah,
in the trailer
this
to mess
is just
us.
The messing with us.
Yeah. But they say, you are ready to receive us. I feel like that must be the spores.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the obvious conclusion to draw. I mean, I wonder whether what the spores have got to say is going to be positive, because this is the thing that annoys me about Aelith, is he seems to assume that whatever message the artifact is trying to impart is going to be a positive message, is going to be something good for humanity, or at least good for humanity from his point of view. How does he know that? What if the spores are, malign? What if the spores are the bad guys? Kia as well. They seem to uncritically make the assumption that making contact with the species is going to be a good thing.
Right.
And we've actually no way of knowing. We've no way of knowing who the spores are, what they want, or what their interest in humanity is.
Yeah. So how do you think the fact that this season is being billed as a psychological thriller, how do you think that might shift things versus season one? We know there's a new... we have Glenn Mazzano and Joy Blake. So what are the vibes you think that are going to maybe change from what we've already seen?
I mean, like I said a minute ago, I think it's sort of interesting that the beacon seems to be physically deteriorating as an environment. So I think we could get some interesting stuff about just making the beacon a livable environment. I think obviously Halen's going to be working through even more grief than he was already working through before.
Right.
Poor guy. I think in terms of being a psychological thriller, I think it's working out what happened to Aster. Is this Talon hallucinating? Is this something real? And it's going to be working out where Harmony's loyalties lie, where this new Beacon Keeper's loyalties lie, and what Aelith and the Column are trying to actually get out of this whole situation, because it's the extent of their motivation is clear, but what they're actually hoping to get out of talking to these aliens, this artifact, like I said a minute ago, is really unclear to me. So I hope the season goes is I hope they wrap up what the artifact is and why these people are so determined to talk to it.
Well, I think we have the answer to why they're so determined to talk to it, which is that I would be too. It's an alien entity. I want to know everything. But then there seems to be two different groups that have, and we need to find out how similar the ideologies of the column and of the, you know, the Aleph's people, the QTA, how similar are they in their interest in the artifact? What are their hopes for, you know, are they hoping to unite all of human thinking in this artifact? Are they hoping to study it, to use it as a model, or just to have contact with further life in general?
Well, I mean, the columns seem to be very clear what they're against. They're against AI, and they're against, like, continued human expansion. Mm-hmm. Into the universe, because the colonies are too far apart, and they fail too often, and it's just not working. The system is just not working. So they're very clear on what they're against. I think it's much less clear what they're actually for. And mm-hmm. like Aleph's motivations are a complete. I mean, we find out what the human that Aleph is based on wanted. He wanted to unite human consciousness, but that's not the same. The AI may be based on a person, but that's not to say that their motives or their intended outcome is the same. Because they actually make it quite clear that this is not the same. This is not the same character. This is not the same.
He certainly thinks he's a different person, a different character, a different entity. But then I have to wonder if he's underestimating at all how much still lingers of his prior psyche.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing we can say is we've got a lot of ground potentially to get through in nine episodes.
Eight
episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, I like, though, the vibes they're setting up in the trailer. We've got this sort of claustrophobia where it feels like Halen's maybe a little bit trapped. We see someone swing an axe into a table. Got to wonder if that's Halen or one of the potential antagonists. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Again, yeah, eight episodes, wrapping up the series, if, you know, it sounds like from Hugh Howey that they really planned this two-season arc. And that it's kind of nice to just know that it will have a conclusion. No more cliffhangers this time.
No more cliffhangers. I want to know what's going on.
Well, I think we'll do probably the same coverage that we did last season, where we cover the first two episodes and then then batches of three episodes at a time to cover the eight episodes. Also we have our Dune coverage plans going forward as well. So we'll get you prepped for the HBO prequel series coming likely this summer. Now, if you want to help us in our mission to analyze all this essential sci-fi, then please share this episode with a friend, anyone who is interested in this series or you think would be interested in this series. It's very helpful if you leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening, because that helps the algorithm tell more people that they might like this podcast as well. And we, of course, want to hear from you directly. Luke, where can people find you?
So they can find me at Luke F. Midup on Twitter, and the same handle.
I think you're just Luke Midup.
I'm just Luke Midup. Yeah, sorry. I'm just Luke Midup on Twitter, and I'm Luke F. Midup on Blue Sky. And I'm not calling it X, and I will never call it X.
No, I'm with you.
Screw you, Elon. So those are where they can find me. I also do another podcast with a couple of friends from university that, again, we've just started to pick that up so that it could be said. We look at British politics, international politics, and we've started to branch out into doing film reviews, little pieces of reviews of art and other stuff. So we're starting to branch out a little bit from,
and we can look forward to one of podcast. We can look forward to one of your co-hosts from there joining us for the Dune.
Yeah, my friend Will would like to join us when we get to the Villeneuve movies, part of the Dune series.
Yeah. And you can find me at Alicia CB, and you can also get in touch with us via email at woolshiftdustpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, there's also the Woolshift Dust Book Club, where you'll find part two of the Hugh Howey interview that you just heard in this episode. And also there will be the breakdown of the book Shift is coming now that I'm finally back in the editing chair. And also I would like to thank our newest Silasins, Rebecca G. and Tom C. Thank you and welcome to the clubhouse. We look forward to seeing you at the next meeting. Hope you brought snacks. I was also recently on the House of the Dragon podcast, Electric Bookaloo, talking about Sansa, the Lannisters, and the Hound, and Clash of the Kings, the second book in the Game of Thrones series. So if you're interested in that, definitely check that out. And also stay tuned, Star Wars fans, because there's a new podcast announcement coming later this month, beginning of May. More on that to come soon. Now, this has been We'll Shift Dust, published by the Lorehounds, produced by me. Also on the Lorehounds Network, you'll find me popping up on occasional Shogun coverage. They're doing full episode by episode coverage, which we're also talking about on the Discord. You can find that link in the show notes as well. And we also just wrapped up there the Oscar series. So talking through all of the nominees, actually, but especially the top 10, the 10 Best Picture nominees. And yeah, they're covering so many more shows there. Properly Howard is also another podcast, soon back with another season of Silly Movie Reviews. We have a brand new podcast in the network, Rings and Rituals, by our favorite Tolkien scholar, Marilyn R. Perkila, joined by another Tolkien scholar. And they are going back through the Rings of Power series, one episode at a time, breaking down the rituals that you find there and, you know, talking about ritual in both Tolkien's world and also the real world. And add to that, soon there'll be a new Fallout podcast coming to the Lorehounds Network, which I'm sure will especially be interesting to Silo fans. Gotta love that underground life. So more info on that soon. Any final words before we go, Luke?
No, I think that summed up everything nicely. It's great to be back. The one thing I will say is it's great to be back.
Yeah, and we'll be back in your ears again soon. Until then, we'll be going to see an AI about an artifact.
Hey listeners, if you've been listening to our show, chances are you've heard the wonderful contributions of our favorite Tolkien scholar, Marilyn R. Perkila. Marilyn just launched her own podcast on our network called Rings and Rituals.
Join me and Dr. Sara Brown on our journey through the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power, through the lens of ritual. Episodes drop every other Wednesday on the Rings and Rituals feed, linked in the show notes. See you there.